Chapter 10, The Innovation Class. In his 2011 State of the Union address, President Obama addressed the plight of the country's working people, of Americans who used to be able to get a job for life without having a college degree. The president gave a powerful description of what had happened to them with deindustrialization, their shattered towns, their ruined lives, their piddling paychecks. Ordinarily, this is the point where a Democrat would start laying out his plans to reverse this disaster. A public works program, an end to the exodus of manufacturing, and so on. Not this Democrat. Instead, using the following words, he told those working people that nothing could be done for them. "So yes," he said, "the world has changed. The competition for jobs is real." What has happened to working people was simply real. It was reality. What you do about reality is you get used to it. But then, a few moments later, Obama pivoted to a happier subject. It was 2011. The recession was technically over. His signature healthcare proposal had been enshrined in law, and it was time for him to outline the positive economic program that would define the rest of his presidency. You guessed it, innovation was what we needed more of. "The first step in winning the future," Obama announced, "is encouraging American innovation." On this matter, the president showed no trace of fatalism or resignation before an unalterable reality. On this matter, government could act without any problem. "We needed to subsidize innovators," he said, "and generously in order to spur on more success stories. Since everyone knows that innovation is connected to higher learning, Obama called on students to study harder and for more people to go to college." I remember listening to the president talk about innovation and just tuning it out. At the time, I thought of innovation as a cliché, a generic faith in progress. But Obama was serious about this stuff. Encouraging innovation was to be his great economic vision, his liberal utopia. Bill Clinton had become identified with the dot-com new economy by accident. Barack Obama was going to do it deliberately. A month after that State of the Union speech, the White House made it official. "America's future economic growth and international competitiveness depend on our capacity to innovate," a policy document declared. "To win the future, we must out-innovate, out-educate, and out-build the rest of the world." What's good for Google? I have described Barack Obama's commitment to traditional democratic concerns as falling somewhere between indifferent and icy. The financial industry, however, has seen him as a red-hot radical since his first days in office. In 2008, they had sided with Obama over John McCain, but by 2012, Wall Street stood solid behind the Republican Romney. No matter. By that time, the place once filled by finance in the Democratic imagination had begun giving way to Silicon Valley, a different creative class industry with billions to give in campaign contributions. Changes in the administration's personnel paralleled the money story. At the beginning of the Obama years, the government's revolving doors had all connected to Wall Street. Within a few years, the people spinning them were either coming from or heading toward the West Coast. In 2014, David Plouffe, the architect of Obama's inspiring first presidential campaign, began to work his political magic for Uber. Jay Carney, the president's former press secretary, hired on at Amazon the following year. Larry Summers, for his part, became an advisor for an outfit called OpenGov. Back in Washington, meanwhile, the president established a special federal unit that used Silicon Valley techniques and personnel to revolutionize the government's web presence. Star-struck tech journalists call it Obama's stealth startup. The mutual attraction between the president and Silicon Valley had actually begun during Obama's first campaign, when he famously used Facebook to connect with the young. His re-election effort was the first to use big data and micro-targeting to find swing voters. Some observers like to imagine the Obama campaigns as triumphant social movements. Others see them as triumphs of quite a different nature, as electronic victories demonstrating the irresistible power of digital networks. For people who take the latter view, the Obama presidency is another triumphant iteration of the story Silicon Valley loves to tell itself, the tale of the brilliant startup challenging the slow-moving incumbent, of the scrappy underdog who takes on the conservative dinosaur. Obama is thus said to be, in a typical bit of liberal class narcissism, the first tech president. The tech people themselves go further. A prominent Silicon Valley venture capitalist calls him the greatest president of my lifetime. This is virtually the last surviving form of Obama idealism out there, still going strong in the president's final year in office. The administration's relationship with Silicon Valley has never caused the kind of controversy that his former closeness with Wall Street did, probably because Silicon Valley has never contrived to toss the world economy into a wood chipper. Also, it's hard to hate this industry, regardless of what they do. An aura of youthful lightheartedness seems to envelop every interaction between the president and the techies. After all, one notable manifestation of Obama's outreach to this powerful industry was his farcical 2015 interview with YouTube comedian Glozell Green. Another was this famous exchange with Mark Zuckerberg in the course of a town hall meeting at Facebook headquarters, during which Obama proposed that the rich should pay higher taxes than they currently do. Zuckerberg: I'm cool with that. Obama: I know you're okay with that. In the 1980s and 1990s, Silicon Valley was not a particularly democratic industry. Its libertarianism was well known and the subject of endless fascination. Its leaders were among the richest people in the world, and its great chronicler and booster at the time, George Gilder, was a prominent conservative intellectual whose works had been influential in the Reagan years. Gilder's take on Silicon Valley's politics went far beyond the partisan preferences of its leading figures. The primacy of market economics, Gilder said, was actually inscribed in the structure of the microchip itself. By its very architecture, tech was supposed to work against economic authority of the taxing and regulating kind. Not anymore. Today, Silicon Valley's prosperity is supposed to be the ultimate demonstration of the worthiness of the liberal class. Just look at how the post-industrial society has singled out the educated and the creative, the engineers and the scientists. See how it has showered them with economic rewards beyond imagining. History itself has elevated this one industry over all others, and with it the Democrats have prospered as well, since they long ago positioned themselves as the party of the modern world's winners. You may be drowning, but the rising tide is lifting their boat very nicely. When Democrats talk about tech, sooner or later they always go back to the search engine giant Google. In The Audacity of Hope, Barack Obama tells how he made a pilgrimage to the company's headquarters as a senator, and as president, according to a Wall Street Journal story from 2015, he went on to name-check Google in fully half of his State of the Union speeches. Google employees made up the third largest group of contributors to Obama's 2012 campaign, and Eric Schmidt pops up in the annals of modern liberalism with a curious regularity. He served on Obama's Transition Economic Advisory Board, for example, and even stood on the stage with the president-elect and his economic advisors during Obama's news conference 3 days after the 2008 election. During the 2012 race, Schmidt advised Obama's team on its famous big data strategy. In 2015, Schmidt launched a political technology startup that is supposed to deliver the latest techniques in digital voter identification to the Hillary Clinton presidential campaign. He is the liberal class's favorite billionaire. Schmidt's own writing makes it obvious why he and Google appeal so strongly to the Democrats. The party and the company are traveling parallel cultural tracks. Schmidt begins his 2014 management book, How Google Works, by playing up the company's academic pedigree. After launching Google out of a dorm room, the two founders acted, quote, like the professors in their Stanford computer science lab, and gave the smart young professionals they hired maximum freedom. The company they proceeded to build, according to Schmidt, is a meritocracy, a place where the smartest prevail, where bias and prejudice count for nothing, where the best ideas win out. The ideal economic actor in this context is one Schmidt calls the smart creative. In our industry, she is most likely a computer scientist, Schmidt writes. But in other industries, she may be a doctor, designer, scientist, filmmaker, engineer, chef, or mathematician. She is an expert in doing. She is analytically smart. She is business smart. She is competitive smart. She is user smart. She is curious creative. She is risky creative. She is self-directed creative. She is open creative. She is thorough creative. She is communicative creative. It is a little tiresome, is it not? We've heard about the learning class, the wired workers, the creative class, and now come the smart creatives. But always, it means the same thing, the well-graduated professionals. In a 2013 public conversation with journalist Walter Isaacson, Schmidt announced that everyone present in the audience was a faithful worshiper in the Church of the Knowledge Economy, a stage of the development of civilization in which wealth is created by entrepreneurs and innovation. When Schmidt was asked what America might do to get its economy going again, the answer was predictable. What we need to do is come up with policies which actually allow the creative people who can create value and invent new things to do their stuff. If we put these people first, we will enjoy huge new jobs, he said, huge new choices of employment. As an example of the kind of thing these people might come up with, Schmidt mentioned driverless cars, a legendary Google project that, if it is ever perfected, might make redundant everyone who drives a taxi, limo, or semi-trailer truck. The short-term effect of such an efficiency would obviously be to increase unemployment, not reduce it. In the bailout days, you might recall, people were outraged to learn that, thanks to the number of federal officials drawn from Goldman Sachs, one of its nicknames was Government Sachs. Now, though, as the Obama years draw to a close, it's the United States of Google that should concern us more. I mean this not just in terms of the revolving door between Google and government, or the weird ubiquity of Eric Schmidt in Democratic Party gatherings, but in a grander way as well. Google's vast ambitions often seem to aim at replacing government. Its core business, to begin with, is providing services that will be the public utilities of the 21st century, searching the internet, for example, or communicating via email. In my fiscally challenged hometown of Kansas City, Google even got the rights to set up a local fiber optic broadband system, making Google a public utility by definition, although one that is not obliged to provide service to everyone. Then there's the spying. In his important 2013 book, Who Owns the Future?, the tech writer Jaron Lanier describes the emerging internet giants of our time as third-party spy services. Many of them, he argues, make their profits via the creation of ultra-secret mega-dossiers about what others are doing. Everything else they offer, retail sales, connecting with friends, searching the internet, is secondary. Back to Google, the liberal class's favorite internet company. They track your web searches to sell you stuff. They scan your emails to sell you more stuff. For those who are worried about the loss of privacy such practices seem to portend, Eric Schmidt tells us, in a book co-written with a former advisor to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, that it's all inevitable anyway, nothing we can do about it. In the future, they write, by the time a man is in his 40s, he will have accumulated and stored a comprehensive online narrative, all facts and fictions, every misstep and every triumph, spanning every phase of his life. Even the rumors will live forever. The aim of such a statement, obviously, is to make Google's scary business model seem like no big deal, just the future doing what comes naturally. Even so, the scary side keeps peeking through. Schmidt's single most famous statement, delivered to a CNBC talker in 2009, is a direct rationalization of surveillance for profit. Here's what he said. If you have something that you don't want anyone to know, maybe you shouldn't be doing it in the first place. The way to react to a world in which you are under observation at all times, in other words, is simply to never step out of line. Inequality. What's wrong with liberals embracing tech and innovation? Surely it's not an expensive passion like mass transit or Medicare or the hundreds of other things Democrats love to blow money on. Even if it seems like empty rhetoric, there's still a small chance that something good will come of it. Maybe a bunch of students with a really awesome idea will enter a contest at a startup incubator somewhere and win the eye of a friendly billionaire, and next thing you know, we'll all be driving cars that don't pollute or something. I mean, it might happen. Why not give it a shot? Besides, nobody is against innovation. It's the subject of an enormous literature, a literature that sells well and is almost entirely laudatory. President Obama says innovation is how to win the future. Democratic governors across the country agree with him. It is as pure-hearted an undertaking as the liberal mind can conceive. In fact, the culture of innovation is so pure and so stridently noble that it often sounds like advertising. You hear about the startup that's going to help with sanitation in African cities, the one that's going to print out prosthetic hands for disabled children, the one that's procuring clothes for homeless children. We're with people who are curing cancer in a different way and changing banking technology and helping folks who can't see anymore, says a woman in a short YouTube video about Mass Challenge. Inno is going to solve global warming. Inno is coming up with new treatments for autism. Inno is so inherently moral that there's even a UNICEF innovation team. Dial up its homepage and you will encounter the following introductory sentence. In 2015, innovation is vital to the state of the world's children. The fog of righteousness surrounding this concept is so thick, it allows all manner of absurdly altruistic claims. Can startups help solve Boston's biggest problems? Asked an email I received last spring. Of course they can. The group that sent it, City Start Boston, announced plans to mobilize the entire Boston startup ecosystem to collaborate to develop viable ventures design... Wait. Stop here for a moment, listener, and try to guess. In what way is the startup ecosystem going to collaborate to solve Boston's biggest problems? If you guessed to enhance innovation in Boston's neighborhoods, you were right. Startups are going to collaborate to enhance startups. This struck me as a pretty basic misunderstanding of the way capitalism works, as does, in fact, the whole notion of a nurturing ecosystem dedicated to mentoring and incubating other people's precious startups. It's a basic misunderstanding of ecology, too, but we'll let that pass. Other than the chance to make some money, why would a capitalist participate in such a thing? If startups really were to encourage other startups, they would be contributing pretty directly to their own competition. And robust competition is precisely what today's thinking business person wants to avoid. The winning quality today is monopoly, not competition. But this is not a literature given to subtlety or introspection. As the tech writer Evgeny Morozov points out in To Save Everything, Click Here, the cult of innovation holds every info-age novelty to be inherently good in itself, regardless of its social or political consequences. Sure enough, as far as I've been able to determine, few of the people who write or talk about innovation even acknowledge the possibility that innovations might be harmful instead of noble and productive. And yet recent history is littered with exactly such stuff, innovations that allow companies to spy on us, innovations that allow terrorist groups to recruit online, innovations that allowed Enron to do all the fine things it used to do. Come to think of it, the whole economic debacle of the last 10 years owes its existence to the financial innovations of the 90s and the aughts, the credit default swaps, or the algorithms that companies used to use to hand out mortgage loans. Innovations that were celebrated in their day in the same mindlessly positive way we celebrate tech today. Somehow that stuff never comes up, however. We know what innovation is about, and it's righteousness and triumph. Success is all you'll find when you riffle through the InnoThoughts produced by the various foundations, institutes, websites, mentors, accelerators, incubators, and entrepreneurship competitions. You hear about startups that just raised $3.1 million in venture capital. Startups that are partnering with some more established operation from California. Startups that have made their starter-uppers into billionaires. Inno is about egalitarianism as well. Indeed, as the preeminent expression of the endless American uprising against the entrenched and the powerful, how could it be otherwise? Inequality is, by definition, just one more problem our lovable entrepreneurs have set out to solve, and in the eyes of some, they have succeeded. Mark Andreessen, the famous venture capitalist, has described the vacation rental platform Airbnb as a solution for income inequality. Chris Lehane, a former assistant to Bill Clinton and Al Gore, who now does public affairs for Airbnb, has said the same thing. Objecting to proposed regulation of the company, Lehane has said that cities understand that in a time of economic inequality, this is a question of whose side are you on? Do you want to be on the side of the middle class, or do you want to be opposed to the middle class? David Plouffe, Obama's great people mobilizer, now sells the freelance taxi app Uber with the same workerist pitch he once used to sell Obama, as the solution to the recession. There are still too many people who aren't feeling the full effects of the recovery and too many people who are still looking for work, he said in a speech at a Washington incubator in 2015. But Uber, for whom anyone could sign up and drive, is, quote, making a real and growing difference when it comes to the challenges of wage stagnation and underemployment. During a talk at South by Southwest in 2014, Eric Schmidt lamented the effects of growing inequality on places like San Francisco, where the cost of living has ascended out of most people's reach. But he declared that the solutions all involve creating more fast-growing startups. The answer, he told the audience, was a society-wide acceptance of Inno as a way of life. Each and every one of us, he said, must be in favor of more education, more analytical education, more immigration, more capital formation, more creative areas, more areas that are allowed by regulation to be unregulated, so that startups can actually flourish in them and we can get through this.